Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm editor Candace Gibson, joined by staff writer Jane McGrath.
Hey there.
We love getting listener feedback, especially when it's complimentary. But we also like it when you guys ask very deep and probing questions or simply make requests of us. And we have one such request from Mike, who unfortunately did not include his last name. But Mike, if you hear this email and know it's you, write us back and we'll say your full name on our next podcast. So Mike writes, I really enjoyed listening to this podcast. I'd like to hear more topics about American history. However, why not try how Reconstruction worked or how slavery worked? These topics might be more contentious, but I think the discussions would be interesting to listen to. Well, Mike, we love American history, too, and we try to spread the love between all different continents and all different eras and civilizations, et cetera, as long as we mention Thomas Jefferson in every podcast. But we are going to talk about civil rights today, the civil rights movement in particular, because as most of you know, this was sort of a burgeoning movement beginning when people started noticing the inherent evil in slavery, but it took a really, really long time for things to come full scale and for blacks to be given their full civil rights. So it's a very complicated history, and we're going to do our best to cover most of it.
That's right, and we're going to start back about with the Jim Crow laws. During Reconstruction, the Southern states instituted rules, basically, that prevented blacks from taking advantage of the freedom that they had just got. And so they made rules that separated blacks and whites in restaurants, parks, and theaters, you name it, basically. And this was later legitimized by a Supreme Court case called Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. And it really made it said, like, separate but equal is constitutional. It's fine. You can make laws about it. And it's really sad.
And it's also really scary, too, because the Constitution added the 14th Amendment, which made clear that citizenship was to be bestowed on freed slaves.
That's right. Full and equal. And that's where we have equal, and that's where they get the little nitpicky, like, oh,
right.
It's equal. Sorry, I didn't mean to
interrupt. Oh, no, you're fine. But the problem with the 14th Amendment is that it was never ratified by most of the Southern states. Mm-hmm. And during Reconstruction, the South actually had military members who came in to oversee that they were upholding universal male suffrage, mm-hmm. and they weren't. And the problem with the Jim Crow laws that Jane was alluding to earlier is that they made things inherently difficult for freed black men. Sure, they were supposed to be enfranchised, but mm-hmm. they couldn't vote because when they got to the voting booths, they were hit with poll taxes or they were hit with literacy tests or all these other tricks that white Southerners had up their sleeves to keep them from participating in society.
That's right. And obviously, these blacks were at a disadvantage because they were deprived of the education that it took to have literacy at that time. So the Southerners knew exactly what they were doing.
And they did.
It's completely unfair rules.
And it wasn't just about voting. They also banned interracial marriages, mm-hmm. and they segregated public places like schools and parks and different modes of transportation. And I'm sure you're all incredibly familiar with the Rosa Parks story, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But another example of that, like buses and vehicles people would take essentially to get to these locales that mm-hmm. when they arrived, they would find were separate but not equal. And we know that lynching was a constant threat. The Ku Klux Klan was alive and well. And the problem with these lynch mobs and other violent members of white society was that when they were called to court, they were essentially reviewed by all white juries who mm-hmm. typically found them innocent. So it was just a constant cycle of wrong.
Yeah, and a lot of this violence stemmed from just the strict rules even in their society that they formed. Like if a black person looked at a white person the wrong way, it could instigate violence that would later be acquitted by an all-white jury.
So I want to get back to what Jane was saying earlier about Plessy versus Ferguson, because this is such an important precedent to the whole civil rights movement. And that happened back in 1890. Louisiana law had forced blacks to ride in segregated rail cars. And under the 14th Amendment, that really didn't make a lot of sense mm-hmm. because blacks were supposed to have access to all the civil, you know, rights and civil liberties that whites had too. So Plessy tested this, boarding a car that was intended for white people. Plessy was just 1/8 black.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The fact that he's just only 1/8.
1/8, but mm-hmm. was still arrested. And a local judge declared him guilty. And the U.S. Supreme Court, wildly enough, upheld that decision. And they were the ones who said that separate but equal accommodations did not infringe upon 14th Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. And how many times have we heard that refrain throughout, you know, civil rights history, separate but equal, separate but equal? That was ultimately, you know, this thing that set all the wheels in motion for the mm-hmm. whole movement.
And that was not overturned until 1954, which I'm sure you all have heard of the Brown versus Board of Education case. And that finally put the nail in the coffin to Plessy, saying that separate is inherently unequal. And so it violated the 14th Amendment.
And the thing about these historic cases is really the people behind them. And, you know, again, Brown versus Board of Education, probably a court name you've heard tossed around, but to really know the backstory, mm-hmm. an 8-year-old girl named Linda Brown, she had to ride a school bus about 5 miles to a segregated school in her hometown of Topeka. And meanwhile, a school for white children was just a few blocks away from her house, and it was better staffed, had better equipment, better books, things like this. And so her father, the Reverend Oliver Brown, decided he was going to try to enroll her at that school. It just made sense overall,
right.
And he was denied. So he went to the NAACP, and they essentially kept taking the case a little bit further and
other families involved, too, to help with the case as well.
They did. And again, this was ruled on the precedent of Plessy versus Ferguson, separate, not being equal. And here mm-hmm. is a very, very stark example of how it's not. I mean, you could look at these two schools side by side, the staff that was there, what the children were entitled to, the type of education they were getting. And it couldn't be more obvious.
That's right. And it delivered sort of a final blow against Plessy, because there were court cases beforehand that started to chip away at Plessy. And give you an example, there was a case in 1946 where they banned segregation on interstate bus travel. That's going to come into play later, but it wasn't quite the nail in the coffin that Brown versus Board was.
So when Brown and the NAACP appealed the local judge's decision, mm-hmm. that upheld Plessy versus Ferguson, they went to the Supreme Court, and like Jane said, in May 1954, that was when they said that separate but equal was unconstitutional, and thus began the desegregation of schools.
And you'd think, I mean, obviously this was a major step in the civil rights movement, but it didn't immediately make things better. if anything, it sort of made hostilities worse, in the South at least, between blacks and whites. And to give you an example, if you've heard of the Emmett Till case, it's an extremely sad case. It happened just a few months after the decision was released about Brown versus Board of Education. It had to do with just a 14-year-old African-American boy who, he lived in Chicago at the time, but he was visiting the South in Money, Mississippi, to visit relatives. And he was there for a few days, and he was hanging out with his friends. And teasing them. He's showing them a picture of this white girl and saying, oh, that's my girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. They didn't believe him. And they said, oh, why don't you go flirt with the white girl inside the store there? And so he did. And this caused a lot of problems.
It really did. Because just a couple nights later, he was kidnapped from the house where he was staying.
Right.
And he disappeared until his body was found drowned in a river. There was barbed wire around his neck. There mm-hmm. was a bullet hole in his skull. He had been so badly mutilated and tortured that his body was unrecognizable except for a ring that he was wearing. And that's how they identified him.
And it was very obvious who and why this murder happened. Somebody was knocking on the door in the middle of the night asking to see the boy, and the uncle, the person he was visiting, he couldn't resist them, and it was the husband of the girl that Emmett had been flirting with, and he had come back from a trip and found out what happened, and found out the story, and immediately went over and took the boy and put him in the car and drove away.
And this man, Rod Bryant, he was working in conjunction with the owner of the store mm-hmm. where the incident took place, and that was J.M. Millam. And to be specific, for what we know, exactly what Emmett said to the woman was, bye-bye, baby, when he turned to leave.
Right.
So, again, not exactly damning words, but in this case, you know, they really were for him. And, again, this is another instance of an all-white jury not finding the guilty parties guilty. And if you look at pictures from, you know, Roy Bryant and J.M. Millam in court, I think Roy Bryant is sitting there, you know, looking completely nonchalant, smoking a cigarette, as though he hasn't a care in the world. He knew that he would be acquitted. And Emmett Till's mother, obviously, you know, one can assume she must have just been heartbroken, but she, I think, very valiantly turned this into an opportunity to advance the civil rights movement.
Sure.
And at the boy's funeral, she insisted upon an open casket. And again, remember, his body was so mutilated when they found it, they couldn't recognize him. He'd been in the river for a couple of days. It must have been a horrific sight to see.
Yeah.
And I think that that is really what stirred, especially younger generations mm-hmm. of Black Americans, to say, this is wrong. I mean, we knew it was wrong all along, but there's a big difference between a schoolgirl being denied entrance to a school mm-hmm. and this sort of very violent atrocity that's occurring under our watch.
That's right. I think it really awakened everybody, the whole nation, really, because I remember reading that the image of his mutilated body was printed in a magazine at the time. So not even just the people who went and saw his body in person, but all around the country, people who bought that magazine could see how disgusting this was. And it's interesting also to compare. Emmett Till himself, growing up in Chicago, was not used to the way of the South and the unspoken
right.
rules that were going on there. And so really, you know, it illustrated for everyone very clearly the difference and how not even a teenage boy is safe from the violence.
But the South, and, you know, we're Southerners and we live in the mm-hmm. South today, and House of Forks is in Atlanta. And so, you know, we're aware of Southern culture and attitudes. So we don't mean to constantly be pointing fingers at the South, but this is where all the activity was brewing. It's important to note, too, that it was a very, very stalwart section of the country, even mm-hmm. though these laws were being passed, even though desegregation in schools was made mandatory, like you saw or heard when Jane and I podcasted about the Emancipation Proclamation. It takes a long time for these things to seep into the collective mindset. And even if people know it's the law in black and white, trying to get people to embrace something, you know, with their minds and with their attitudes takes a really long time. And especially when you have general unrest among populations, you know, that sort of boils up into a mob situation. And mm-hmm. that's why, very famously, back in September 1957, President Dwight Eisenhower sent 1,000 paratroopers to oversee 9 black students entering Little Rock High School in Arkansas.
Yeah,
because he knew it would happen.
That's right. And this was, again, a very dramatic scene, like on the television and everything, for the whole nation to see how bad things were.
Yes. And so we see the sort of violence being committed against the black community, and how did they respond? Well, with civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. And this is perhaps one of the wisest maneuvers I think any group of people has really made, because to fight back with violence, with nonviolence, is a very shocking and I think brave thing to do.
It sort of inherited the ideas of Gandhi, very popular at that time. And one of the examples of civil disobedience that was very popular and effective were these things called sit-ins, where black youths usually would go into all-white establishments, or at least establishments that had all-white sections, such as a counter that only whites could sit at, and they would ask to be served. And they had a code of nonviolence where, like, even if they were being hit or whatever, they could not respond with any violence, and they couldn't insult anyone else, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the most famous cases of civil disobedience that we mentioned earlier and said we'd come back to is Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. And this happened in Montgomery, Alabama. It was December 1st, 1955. After a day of work, she sat down on the bus, and when enough whites boarded that she was, you know, being forced by code to give up her seat, mm-hmm. she refused. And I think a lot of people think that she did this on the spur of the moment. And
yeah, it was no sudden flight of stubbornness.
It wasn't. And thinking that she very, you know, resolutely refused to give up her seat, I think, paints her as a larger-than-life figure. And while she certainly was a heroic figure in the movement, she had gone to courses on civil disobedience.
I don't know. I think that raises her estimation in my eyes. It's like, oh, that's, you know, this was planned out, and she had the guts to do this. It wasn't just sort of she was having a bad day, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So from that perspective, she's even larger than life. So, and this was actually part of a bus boycott movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has started it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So activists in Montgomery, the city where this happened, they started a Montgomery Improvement Association, and this it started a boycott, and this lasted for over a year until the courts finally made the city desegregate. And it was a huge success. You know, it was one of the first big successes for the civil rights movement, especially the civil disobedience movement as well. And this is when a famous figure, Martin Luther King Jr., came into play as well. He was a pastor in a church in Montgomery during the time of the boycott. And when that was successful, actually, I should mention that during the boycott, he was faced with a lot of danger as well. His home was actually bombed that year when he wasn't there, I believe. And once the boycott was finally successful, he was elected the first president of the Southern Christian Leadership Council. And this focused on peaceful protest and became a major force in the movement.
And King didn't stay in Montgomery. He ended up moving to Atlanta for a while. And then we know that eventually he went over to Birmingham. But while he was starting, and it was the sort of burgeoning effort of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, we really see this rolling effort with bus boycotts and nationwide protests and sit-ins and all of this to sort of gently buck the Supreme Court's, you know, ruling and decisions, and to really draw attention to what was happening in the South, and to point out, you know, we're the ones who have these rights. They're being taken away from us. They're not being honored. And we're not fighting back like the white community. You know, we're doing this very, very gently, as it were.
Yeah, that's true. And he faced a lot of criticism from both sides. What was surprising to me was the fact that fellow pastors in Birmingham were attacking him for being too extremist. And he wrote, one time he was arrested. Well, he was arrested a few times. But at one point he was in the Birmingham jail, and he wrote the infamous letter from Birmingham jail to his fellow pastors who were criticizing him. And one of my favorite lines from that famous document is, "So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be." And I think that's very inspiring, personally, and one of my favorite lines.
My favorite line is, "Justice too long is justice denied."
That's a great one, too.
Yeah. And I think it really speaks to King's perspective on the movement. So while we have King and civil disobedience going on and all of the followers that are following him, we also should mention another group, the Freedom Riders. Mm-hmm. And on May 4th, 1961, this was a group of people of several different races, and they were going to make sort of a cross-country or cross-South, really, statement.
That's right. And they were testing some rules that were recently instituted. Like I mentioned before, that as early as 1946, there was a ban on segregation on interstate bus travel. Well, in 1960, there was another decision related to this where they extended the rule to bus terminals. And so the terminals themselves had to be desegregated as well. And so this group of freedom riders that Candace was just talking about, whites and blacks banded together to really test this ruling. And they kind of knew what they were doing. They knew that the South was not ready for this.
They knew what they were getting into, and they rode from Washington, D.C., to New Orleans, mm-hmm. and along the way, they were beaten, their buses were stoned, their tires were slashed, 300 of them were arrested, and the bus never finished the trip.
That's right. It sounded like such a scary thing to go on, this crusade that they went on, because they were beaten, you know, their bus was firebombed. I can't even imagine, like, how scary it was to be there.
But the bright side is that their efforts caught the attention of the Kennedy administration. So after Kennedy started turning an eye to what was going on, he decided that he was going to take a more active role. You mm-hmm. know, as we know, the Supreme Court hadn't been exactly up to snuff, so Kennedy comes into play, and he proposes the Civil Rights Bill. And to show support for this bill, 250,000 people of all races participated in the March on Washington, and that is when King made the famous I Have a Dream speech.
That's right, and actually, JFK was assassinated before the bill could finally go through, but luckily his successor, LBJ, he helped push it along because he knew it was important. And not only the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but the Voting Rights Act of a year later. The first one forbid discrimination in public accommodations. And so, like we said before, this happened sort of with Supreme Court cases, but it was up to the executive branch to really enforce it. And so these were really important. And also what they did was they threatened to withhold federal funds from communities where they persisted in segregation. And that was a real key in getting things moving.
So as all of this is happening, Jane mentioned before media coverage, and I think it's really important to mention that that was such a valuable tool in the civil rights movement, having those pictures splashed across, you know, the front pages of newspapers, having them on TV, mm-hmm. being able to see all of those people in Washington, there to support the bill. And as we know, the graphic images of Emmett Till helped, the images of Martin Luther King, the images of the arrests and the protests, and people's minds really, I think, began to change about the black community and the bills that were coming across to support them. And something else that I think really helped out were the children's protests mm-hmm. that took place. And it came to a point at which there just wasn't enough time and enough manpower to have adults constantly protesting, because after all, you know, these are parents, these are workers with homes and bills to pay. So they asked children to participate in the protests, mm-hmm. and even children were arrested, if you can believe that. And at one point, the city came in with fire hoses and tried hosing them down to get them,
yeah.
you know, off the grounds. And the force from the fire hoses was so strong, so much water pressure, that children were like swept to their feet. They were knocked down. And people saw these images and were just outraged. So when the time came that the bills were passed by Johnson, I think people were more ready to accept that, yeah, it is time for this, because you're committing atrocities not only toward grown people, but mm-hmm. young children as well.
Another really interesting story that had to do with young black children has to do with a church that was bombed in Birmingham. This happened in 63. It was a year before the Civil Rights Act. But in Birmingham, there's this major church, and it was a target because it was a meeting place for a lot of civil rights leaders, like Martin Luther King. And members of the KKK actually threw bombs inside. I think it only killed four people, but those four people happened to be young girls, like 11 and 14, I believe. And it was also a terrible image, a very starking image to see.
And so I think that there was a time when the black community was really trying to uphold Martin Luther King's standards of civil disobedience and nonviolence. But after a while, after these atrocities continued to, you know, pummel their efforts and try to break away at their morale and their cause, there came a point when people said, This might not be working for us anymore. And keep in mind, this isn't the entire community, mm-hmm. but we're talking about a subset of the community.
That's right. And like I said before, King actually faced criticism from both sides. Some people thought he was too extremist. Some people thought he wasn't extremist enough.
Yeah, that he was a pacifist.
Right, exactly. And Malcolm X was one such person, represented the more radical side of the movement. He actually called some of King's tactics criminal. He said it was criminal for King to teach nonviolence in the face of violence. And you can see his point that it's like, it seems to be ineffective. And you can look at the progress and you can say, oh, look at these acts that were passed, et cetera, but look at all the violence that's happening too, and we need to do more.
And I think there came a point when violence was met with violence. We think of the Watts riots that occurred
yeah.
in L.A. And so we have these two almost competing legacies. If you look at the Malcolm X legacy and the Martin Luther King legacy and compare them side by side, this violence versus nonviolence. And we know that even though these bills were passed in the late 60s or the mid 60s even, that wasn't the end.
Yeah, and there was still injustice going on. And going back to your favorite line from from King, justice too long delayed is justice denied. You know, to a lot of people, all this violence going on was justice delayed, you know, and they felt that we needed to do more. And that's an understandable sentiment to have.
And I don't think you can ever wrap up any discussion about the civil rights movement, because I think that there are still plenty of arguments to exist that it's still a movement that is going on today. I think that when Obama was elected president of the United States, I think that really clinched in a lot of people's minds. Maybe we are moving toward the end of the civil rights movement. Maybe this is an end cap to a struggle for true equality.
Yes,
so I think it will be really interesting to watch how our nation continues to embrace other races and evolve together. And I certainly don't want to, you know, project any of my beliefs onto this. I think it's up for our listeners ultimately to decide how they feel about, you know, how history has ended or just begun or is still evolving. I think it's, you know, history is a very organic and living thing, and maybe the civil rights movement isn't over. Maybe the timeline is only in the middle.
Yeah, as long as we're not going backwards, I think that's important.
Exactly. But obviously there's so much more to learn about civil rights and Martin Luther King and other famous historical figures like Malcolm X. So you can read much more about them at HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ+ bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.